Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello, hello, and welcome. Or should I say, welcome back to the Indie Football Podcast. It is the international break, but that does not mean that we take a break from your weekly dose of football analysis breakdown and general chitter-chatter. I am joined this week, to my right, by the Spanish/Irish contingent of Indie Football. That is Miguel Delaney.
All right.
You saw your semi-homeland on Saturday in fine form.
Belting out the anthem.
Yes, yes, I'm sure you were. Jack Pitbrook, you saw your actual homeland in action on Saturday. Were you belting out the anthem too?
Yeah, obviously.
Where do you stand on the English national anthem? Because it's peculiar that England, the football team, use the British national anthem, where Scotland use Flower of Scotland, Wales use Land of Our Fathers. You know, what would you have as the English national anthem before a football game?
I wish I'd prepared a funny answer to that. obviously, I haven't.
Good enough by Dodgy.
Well, I think the correct... Now I've thought about it, I think the answer is actually Clubfoot by Kasabian. I think that would really get people singing along. Yeah. It's a much more sing-along song than God Save the Queen, which, regardless of what you think about the monarchy, is a really, really awful anthem.
It's quite dirge.
So boring.
Dreary.
It doesn't really get you... it doesn't really get you going.
Yeah.
Compared to like all the classic... national anthems.
Yeah. Well, you want the players to have like tears streaming down their face by the end of the anthem. That's the ideal. I was at a wedding a couple of weeks ago, and as part of the wedding, Jerusalem was one of the songs got sung.
Jerusalem's good.
And I Vow to Thee My Country. Both absolute bangers. Yeah. Both in the conversation for potential English national anthem.
I think Jerusalem's a bit overused. I think
correct.
Too many weddings, too many cricket matches.
I've not been to many English weddings, so not overused for me in that way. Been
Land of Hope and Glory, if you know it.
Yeah, that's Macho Man Randy Savage used to have it as entrance.
Great. that's a very good way to know it. That would be my choice. Also, other true fact: I once, I was doing it back in the day when I was working at the Mirror. I was doing a live blog on something. I can't remember what it was, and the English national anthem was played, and I just did like one post, like kind of mildly taking the piss out of it, like saying like, I can't remember who we were playing against, but theirs was like some enthusiastic, brilliant anthem, and ours was. I was like, oh, it's a bit sad, like. Hoping some non-existent being might stop an old German lady from dying, whatever, about God Save the Queen. And my grandma read it and sent me a really terse email saying that I should respect the monarchy a bit more. So welcome to the Indie Football Podcast. Yeah. As I say, we did have England-Spain on Saturday night, at which all three of us were present. And in an interesting experiment of the mind, I was sat with my good lady wife, and you two were both working. And on the way home from the game, I read your reports on my email, and you guys had a very different perspective of the game to me, which is quite nice because it is a little bit of a divergence in thought and in opinion. So put me where you guys are. What do you think about the game on Saturday night? And then we'll talk about my view.
I didn't think England were very good. I think I wrote in my piece that they'd look... Southgate wanted England to show that they were kind of building on what they'd done in the World Cup. But in fact, they looked as... I thought they looked inexperienced and immature. They scored a great goal after 10 minutes, and then after that, they were terrible, really, until about 70 minutes. Like they couldn't keep the ball. They couldn't really lay a finger on Spain. Spain just looked a level above them, really, in terms of experience and quality. And then, I know they could have scored at the end, but they would have been lucky, I think, to get 2-all.
Even Southgate said afterwards that had they equalised through that goal, it wouldn't have changed how he felt about the game, which is that they were kind of Spain... were much better for long periods. And it was a bit weird, even, I remember being surprised slightly when England scored, because just literally half a minute forward, I was thinking, every time Spain press here, England look really uncomfortable on the ball, which is kind of almost crystallises the remaining difference between England and these sort of sides. Now, from they were, England had enough kind of grit about them to get the ball out and kind of set up that break, which was a good goal. But yeah, I mean, ultimately, the game just, I mean, it was that was the entire issue. Technique, particularly technique in the middle of the pitch, and it was something that we'll be, of course, discussing this later on our actual website in written word, but there'll be a piece on it. But Southgate said it after the game, basically, we're England are basically just missing that Modric-style player, that Thiago-style player. It still keeps coming back to that.
Yeah, the England team, they remind me a bit of a donut in the sense that, like, they're delightful and I love them, but there's just a big hole in the middle.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Like, there's nothing you can... Like, Southgate talked about, you know, this time I want us to be better on the ball and better in possession and better under pressure. Mm. But the fact is that when you have Henderson, Ali and Lingard in midfield on Saturday, just as you did for the Croatia semi, you're going to get the same result.
In the Monday's briefing afterwards, sorry, it was put to Southgate whether, how do you fix this problem? And he kind of hesitated a bit. And you kind of tell, well, anyway, this is my own take. I was thinking, like, it was as if he wanted to say, basically, you can't fix the problem, basically, unless you actually have a player like that. Otherwise, you're just working around it. It's something we see again. I wrote about it yesterday for Sunday morning after the game. But it still is just a decisive area international. No matter how you try and spin it, you can maybe get away with it for 5-6 games, as Greece did 2004, as England did a bit in this World Cup. But ultimately, if you have that midfielder that really elevates teams,
I completely agree with that. I think there is... obviously an issue with sort of midfielder England are producing and what you'd give for someone like Michael Carrick to play in that Jordan Henderson role. A piece I wrote yesterday, I can't even remember if it got published actually in the end, it might still be waiting. But what I was trying to focus on was looking at Spain's new start under Luis Enrique. The whole of Spain after the World Cup was a bit traumatised because where they were at the last World Cup this summer was... We are a team who are trying to get back to our great heights by playing the same football that got us back to our great heights. And essentially, that football, except for maybe like the peak Guardiola teams, has been found out a little bit. And the sterile possession that came with...
I'm not sure. I disagree with that because I think the issue... And there's the same argument going on about Germany now. The issue isn't that the style of football is wrong. It's that neither Spain nor Germany in the last World Cup played the style that made them great. There was something missing. And I think particularly with Spain, actually, I mean, everyone goes on about the directness, which is one issue, but also the pressing. Which is why I think they became a parody themselves in that Russia game.
But against Russia, I mean, against Russia, they had all of the ball.
Yeah,
you know,
but they did nothing with it.
They completed over 1,000 passes, which is like unheard of. The point is, they were passing it in a U-shape, essentially, round the penalty area. That was the whole problem, was that this is what they were doing. They were kind of, that's like the worst of tiki-taka, is what people were saying on the day, I remember. And no one wanted to see that again from Spain. That's what the biggest concern in Spain ahead of this game was the style of play. Mm. And they wanted verticality, as they call it, which is you know, more direct attacking. And they got it. They were really good. Essentially, Spain were very comfortable with their personnel, and what they wanted was a change in style, and they got it. And what England had was they had a style, but they needed maybe a little alteration in personnel, and they didn't quite get it. Because Jordan Henderson, I think, is probably the best player to play in the role that he's playing in the 3-1-4-2, but I don't think he's the ideal player to have there. I just think he's the best available.
Yeah, I agree with that.
It does feel as if Southgate hasn't quite figured out that midfield. I think, did you allude to it in your... how basically it's a system that... it doesn't get the best out of Lingard or Ali.
Yeah, yeah.
So Lingard and Ali are too similar, aren't they?
Yeah.
Well, I like both of them. And I think, like, he should be trying to get them in the team. My thing is this. A lot of the time at the game on Saturday night, you'd have... someone would have the ball in the England half. Spain would drop off basically to kind of a 4, a 5, then a bit of a gap, then a 1. And the 4 and the 5 kind of quite tight together. They were set up pretty compact. And then what would have to happen to try and create something is Lingard or Ali essentially in the end, because they were marking Henderson, who was supposed to be the pivot out ball sort of guy. So Lingard or Ali has to sprint backwards into their own half. They receive a pass with facing their own goal, about 30 or 40 yards max from their own goal. And they've got someone chasing them the whole time. So the first touch is just to pass it straight backwards again. So... They weren't really providing a proper outlet at any point. I think that Henderson would actually be far suit. Kind of imagine these two are like, they're like two pistons, aren't they? They're two box-to-box sort of roles, really. They need to be guys who are getting up into the other penalty area to provide numbers, but also getting back to help out Henderson. At times, they weren't doing either, almost. Henderson, I think, would be better suited to the right-hand role of that. And Loftus-Cheek, I think, is a better one than Lingard. But in midfield, like, you know, you haven't got the person to play the deeper role. You know, Dyer is the alternative, and I'd rather have Henderson there than Dyer.
Dyer was a disaster in the World Cup. Yeah. Like, every time he came on, he made England worse.
It almost felt on Saturday as if it's a bit of Southgate's default sub, isn't it? Try and get that midfield, but just kind of makes problems worse. I mean, here, I suppose you could maybe understand the rationale, because maybe just to stem the tide, but it often does the opposite, because the way Dyer plays just invites the midfield on more.
But what happened there is so, like Henderson has said, got a little bit isolated if Ali and Lingard both weren't going backwards. For neither of them, it's not their instinct to go backwards. You know, they're both naturally attacking players. So at times, Henderson's kind of isolated against a triangle of really, really good Spanish midfielders, which is difficult. And you look at the...
And he was saying after the game that basically England weren't compact enough in the first half, and that's why they got themselves into so much trouble.
And basically,
Lingard and Ali were too far away from him.
Yeah.
It was only in the second half when they got a bit closer to him that England were able to, you know, to kind of get a foothold back in the game. But the personnel just doesn't really fit, does it, in that system how he wants to play.
Do you play Stones there, maybe?
Well, actually, in the last like 10 minutes, when Dyer increasingly dropped into the back three and Stones was increasingly pushed further forward. I mean, Stones is much better on the ball than Dyer.
That's it. Like, and Stones is basically the closest thing they have to a player that can play in that kind of that
Carrick.
Yeah,
Given that they don't have a Carrick. Mm. That's because even the good players who they have in other role, like, I mean, we talked last week about Will Hughes and James Maddison. Mm. Hughes is maybe slightly more of a number eight, Maddison more of a number 10, but they don't have anyone to be that kind of Carrick type player, do they? Mm. The closest thing I can think of is Oliver Skipp at Tottenham, who's like 18 years old.
The guys that we like and we think might be potential England midfielders, none of them really fit the hole that is the issue, right? So Harry Winks, Maddison, Grealish are the guys that get mentioned, I think, a lot. Will Hughes, I suppose you can add into the conversation.
They're all kind of more 8-10s.
Yeah, Winks plays deeper than Grealish and Maddison.
So I think Winks...
Winks could do it.
I think Winks plays the deepest of all those guys. So I think he's maybe like the best solution. Like, as good as Maddison is, I don't think he give you much different from what you get from Ali, for example.
And if you have Winks and then Henderson plays in one of the other two, then is that not going to help Winks more? My other question I have about this is more broadly. So, you know, the thing about international management is that you can only work with the resources you're given.
Mm.
So Gareth Southgate, ahead of the World Cup, I think very smartly decided what he wanted was a formation that, with one minor tweak, you could use against Tunisia use against Belgium. And he found it, because he found this, whatever it is, 3 at the back, 5 at the back, and you just rotated the midfield. You know, I think he envisioned playing Dyer alongside Henderson in the defensive role, and then just one ahead, which we never really got to see at the World Cup.
I think he decided in the March friendlies that he wanted one sitting and in that midfield triangle, he wanted one sitting and two further forward. I can't remember the last time they played with two sitting.
Going forward, with you know, knowing that there's no real tournament games, I guess they do play Spain and Croatia, but no real tournament games going forward. Do you think, you know, the fact that you need someone who can play in that role, and this formation relies on a player being able to play in that role, do you think he's going to have to switch shape? Because part of the thing about being an international manager is you've got to find the best shape for the players you have.
Yeah.
So if there's an obvious problem, does he not have to address that by changing the shape?
It feels a bit harsh in terms of that, because he has solved so much. He's been quite rational and clever about everything and very meticulous. And now... Because it feels like he's hit a finite point with that system, and there's a big problem that still kind of ultimately will fundamentally deny England, he might have to rethink things again.
But I don't see what solutions he can come up with these players to make to work better. The answer is not Dyer alongside Henderson in 4-2-3-1. Like, do you remember the England's last qualifier for the World Cup where it was October 2017, and they beat Slovakia or Slovenia 1-0 at home with the last minute Harry Kane goal. And they had Dyer and Henderson in midfield together, and it was fucking awful. It was so bad. And I think Southgate knows that he can't go back to playing that way with both of them together, and that's why he's chosen one rather than the other.
Does he have to make... I mean, you mentioned that formation there, like a switch between Tunisia and Belgium. Does he have to be a bit more drastic and make England a certain team... But basically, develop two concurrent styles. One for games where England are the better side, and then against anyone who plays a possession game, basically transforming them into.
But that's just killing. That's just killing the that is. To do that would be to kill the idea of having an identity, but which is so important to what he does. Is to have a way of playing.
But if that way of playing is going to be so, because I mean, ultimately it's been proven now you can't play that identity in the really elite matches. And I don't think it goes against the identity.
But how many teams which claim to have an identity have two radically different ways of playing depending on who they're playing against? I can't think of an example.
I'm not sure if it's radically different. It'd be just well. But I mean, to be fair, that's kind of the nature of when you play these sort of games as well. I mean, ultimately, even a Jose Mourinho team, say, who's fundamentally a counter-attacking manager, will have to kind of take the game to inferior sides. So, I mean, you kind of, for anything about the purism of identity and all that, you kind of have to accept the realpolitik of what happens on a pitch in that way.
But I don't think that's how Southgate and the FA see it, though.
I know, yeah. But it's going to leave this problem. And it feels like a problem that can't be solved until... Basically, they develop a number six.
I think you're right that kind of he is trying to stamp an identity on this team. But do you think the identity, Jack, having seen more of England than either of us, do you think they're a possession team or a counter-attack team?
That's a really good question.
I think they look more dangerous as a counter-attack team.
But they hardly... I mean, the counter-attacking goal they scored... the other day on Saturday evening, which was great. I can't remember the last time they scored a goal on the counter like that.
They certainly scored a couple at the World Cup like that. I mean, it was just a finish away sort of thing. But it just struck me that I thought the defenders looked, and you know, at the start, I think one of Southgate's big things when he came into the role was I want defenders who can play the ball, and I want them to be able to pass it around. And I actually thought they looked okay at that.
Yeah, so he was...
It was more their defending. He was
asked on... Yeah, I mean, he was asked on Friday night about this, whether who would have more of the ball. And he was one of those... in the press conference he gave at the Grove, and it was clear that it wasn't a question he was expecting, and he paused over it for a long time before saying, like, well, it depends how good we are with the ball. So you're right. Like, clearly they want to have... He wants to be a team that dominates possession, but he recognises that with the players that he's got, that's going to be difficult. I do think that he will continue to try to be that team, even though there are obvious constraints against him being able to do it, which is the poverty of the players that he's got in that role. You're right. I mean, I don't know what the solution is, but equally, I do think that he's going to continue going in that direction regardless.
On a wider question, and he was about to get into this on Monday night, or on Saturday night for the Monday's Southgate, but do he get his question? I can't remember what it was. But anyway, but basically, do you not think it's a little bit odd that after, I suppose, 15 years of, or 18 years of truly international Premier League influence, when it went from being kind of an English top division to this international league, there hasn't been kind of this cultural conditioning to bring in to create more young passers?
Well, sorry, do you mean, is it surprising that English football doesn't create more?
Yeah, well, I mean, because there's obviously been a long-term cultural issue anyways, in terms of kind of, you know, there's always been this kind of fetishization of the proper box-to-box midfielder and all that,
yeah.
And more a kick-and-rush style or whatever. But given we've had almost 2 decades now of a properly international Premier League, is it not surprising that we haven't seen more of that?
Maybe. It's interesting how most midfielders now that come through English academies want to play as number 10s.
Yeah, yeah.
Like if you ask...
I mean, tens and wingers, apparently.
I was speaking to a director of a big Premier League academy about this, and he says the problem that we've got is that all the lads want to be a number 10.
Mm.
And they don't even... It's not even that they want... he says, well, you've got to say to them, well, what exactly do you want to do on the pitch? Are you going to stop them from scoring? Are you going to score goals yourself? Are you going to get assists? And it's like... But for the kids, it's all like being... It's not really about what you do. Mm. It's just like the profile of being number 10. Mm. They want to be the guy who gets to have the most fun.
Well, I have a couple basically. Of thoughts on that.
And that, I don't... It is interesting why we don't... The academies aren't better at producing players who can play slightly deeper than that.
I've been in conversations with agents before where they felt that basically if you encourage your kid to play as a 10 or a winger, like a 15, 16-year-old guy's in academy, there's just more places for them to get in the team.
Yeah.
And also it's a position where younger players are more likely to be blooded than, for example, a sitting midfielder who can pass the ball. I think there is less of a trust in that.
Yeah.
In the same way that you rarely play young centre-backs. Like even John Stones comes in as a right-back and then goes to
centre-back. Yeah, yeah.
You know, and Joe Gomez is the same. Yeah. You know, like you don't necessarily trust players in that position. Whereas if it's a winger or whatever, you're like, yeah, chuck in the kid, see what happens.
Yeah.
I think we have an instinct here to, if it's a creative player, you do play them closer to goal, basically. That's a sort of mindset thing. You know, I guess if Southgate saw a player he really likes in the under-17s or under-19s and was like, would you consider moving to essentially kind of a more Xabi Alonso style role, that would be the sort of catalyst you'd need to make this change. Because I think that players who are instinctively good passers and naturally creative talents, I think in England, in Northern Europe, I'd say probably full stop, you tend to play them further forward.
But isn't this the thing? I mean, with the FA's ongoing restructuring of entire coaching setup in England and the philosophy and everything, I mean, sure, the one thing about young players wanting to play in those positions, surely the principle has been in, say, particularly Spain and Germany, is that basically give the players the technical skill set so they have that base of foundation, which usually is at the very least conducive to players who can slot in midfield, and then after that, what positions they are best for gradually should begin to develop. But there still seems, and I have talked to people about this, there still seems to be a little bit of a disconnect in what the FA are doing there, and there's still a slight maybe focus on physical attributes and as you say, kind of players wanting to be 10, whereas in Spain or Germany, it's more about, well, just, you know, the initial foundation is the skill set and the technique.
What was it that Southgate was saying about Gascoigne?
Oh, he said, yeah, but he was asked, basically, someone put it to him, like, why don't we have a Modric or a Thiago? And he said, the only player I've seen like that is Gascoigne in my time. I think, as he put it, though, it's not actually just about Gascoigne's technique. It was and I think this is maybe what he was really talking about. It was Gascoigne's willingness, the bravery he had to just get on the ball and express himself.
We talk about Jack Wilshere probably too much in this podcast, but that was one of the hopes of Wilshere, wasn't it? Back in 2010-11, was that he was able to take the ball and beat people.
Yeah.
And he maybe wasn't quite as powerful as Gascoigne, but like I remember that comparison often being made with Gazza.
He's a bit more constrained than Gazza.
Back in 2010. What do you mean?
Like, what I remember most about Gazza is just the range. Like, Wilshere was kind of more, he could burst, but it was burst from kind of fixed positions.
It's a tight space, right? He wouldn't run the length of pitch. Those old clips on YouTube of Gazza scoring for Newcastle, where he'd get the ball like in his own box.
Yeah.
And then like on a muddy pitch, he would just run, he'd kind of run the length of pitch and bang it in.
The amount of space he used to occupy, both in terms of his runs and then the kind of the range of passes he had.
I think is closest to that is, in fact, Palace chairman Steve Parish said it about Grealish. He said he's the best English player I've seen since Gazza.
Really?
And he's got that sort of, picks up the ball,
from
and
an
you,
Irish player,
you never know what's going to happen. You never know what's going to happen when he picks up the ball. I think
Ravel Morrison.
I've said it a lot. I know someone who's trying to move him to the MLS. Loftus-Cheek.
Yeah.
Now, he's not going to get much game time at Chelsea, which is a real problem because he fits the role that Lingard is playing better than Lingard does for England. And I like Lingard. I think Lingard's actually completely surprised me. He's a much better player, I think, than I ever thought he was.
Yeah, me too.
I think I was probably quite harsh on him earlier in his career because I thought he was just a product of Man United and their system and being in a good team. Whereas I think he is actually a legitimately very good player in his own right. Loftus-Cheek fits that role better.
He turned down a photo with the Moose.
Did he?
In the mix zone on Saturday night, yeah.
Sad to see.
That's good. Professional. That is what I want.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
I think we've got, you know, we've got players who could go in there, but they're constrained by the fact that they're not playing club level, so that's another problem. Otherwise, apart from the midfield, which is kind of all we talked about basically after this game, Were you happy with Pickford? Were you happy with the back three, which is slightly different?
I thought England defended really badly. I thought
especially
it was
the second goal.
Yeah, I mean
Maguire got caught out.
First goal, the first goal was a nice move, but it shouldn't have been that easy for Rodrigo to get in behind and pull the ball back, and Saul should have been tracked better. Second goal was bad marking. The way that I forgot who it was.
He
bent that run in between Kane and Gomez in the near post. So it was just really sloppy defending, and that's why. And that will really piss Southgate off.
Set piece defending, right? As well, because he works a lot on set pieces.
But it was interesting how Gomez started ahead of Walker. Like Walker, I thought was really good at the World Cup, but
Gomez is an actual. I think Gomez has speed, which clearly is a thing that they wanted in there.
So does Walker.
But no. Of course, that's why Walker was in there. But I think Walker was in there because they wanted an element of speed to the back line, which was otherwise quite sluggish. Gomez has speed and is an actual centre back.
Yeah.
Gomez twice was caught out of position that I remember, but I only noticed because he made good recovering tackles. Now that's the sort of Sergio Ramos thing, whereas it's like, okay, he made the good recovering tackle, but he shouldn't have been out of position in the first place. You know, and Rafa Varane actually does it a lot. He puts himself in positions where he might have to make the recovering tackle, but he knows he can make it.
On a slight tangent, one of my favourite things about the game was a minute into it, Ramos already being booed. He's on the ball more than anyone. His response to that is to play a brilliant 60-yard ball. I think it was for Rodrigo, who was just offside.
Mm-hmm. What do you think of Spain, Miguel? A couple of new faces, obviously. So Jordi Alba not in there.
Yeah.
And he's been very important for Spain in terms
so
of providing
interesting, given the Luis Enrique history.
Yeah, of course. I mean,
did they have a falling out?
Yeah.
I think Luis Enrique, he's almost a bit Roy Keane level now. Oh, so at one point you will fall out with him.
Yeah, I mean, I just remember that the kind of dying days of his time at Barca, and just he was so rude in press conferences, like all the time. He's so terse with everyone. And, like, you know, he complained about his treatment by the Catalan press, the local Barcelona press and stuff, but it's like, you know, it was a cyclical thing.
Yeah.
Is he thought he was treated harshly, so he treated them like crap. So then they were harsh on him, so he treated them like crap, and it just got worse and worse and worse until he left, basically. But he fell out with Alba, partially because he dropped Alba a lot. He didn't think Alba would play well in kind of the back three as a wing back, when you'd think Alba would be exceptional at that.
Yeah.
But Marcus Alonso played quite well. I thought Carvajal was excellent. He really probably is.
But
Barra right
for the
back.
First goal.
Yeah. But I mean, like, game, he just completely dominated.
And actually, his response to that was
he skinned, Luke Shaw for Spain's equaliser.
He made a couple of unbelievable tackles as well, where it's like, oh, the ball's not there to be. Wow, he's won it. Okay, fair enough.
Actually, this may be slightly. Well, I was actually thinking about this on Thursday night because the Germany France game was so dull. What the actual best 11 in the world is now? Carvajal, Kante in there would be less fashionable.
Okay, well, I mean, we might as well do it. Now you've said that, right, okay.
It's in my head.
I was actually thinking...
Jack,
do you think
schedule's we'll... out? You've got a piece of paper
okay,
there.
Should we all do it now?
Okay, right.
Have we all got paper and pen?
I'm going to do it.
What were you
going to
ask, Jack?
You two have got a bit more thought. I'm going to say my goalkeeper is probably still Manuel Neuer. I think Lloris and Oblak are both very good goalkeepers. I think De Gea is a very good goalkeeper. But Neuer is the perfect modern goalkeeper for me. Danny Carvajal at right back.
I think I've forgotten who all the footballers are. who plays football again?
Yeah. Like Varane, actually. Varane's centre half.
Carvajal, definitely at right back. He's been outstanding for years.
What formation are you going for?
I'm working it as I go along. Varane at centre back for sure.
That's how we do things at the Independent.
No chance we've got Ramos in there.
Yeah, Ramos is going straight in mine. Yeah, sorry, we're doing individual 11s, right? We're not doing a sort of team combined.
In midfield, you've probably got to have Modric, given what he's done over the last few years. And you've got to have... Do you still have to have Iniesta in there, do we think?
No. He plays in Japan.
Okay.
He's done for me. Sorry, Japan.
Who plays, but like, I mean, who plays at wing-back for any team? Mendy?
Carvajal. You've got to have
Carvajal. John Beresford?
I would actually
Warren Back.
I would have had Jordi Alba as the best left back in the world.
Really?
Mm.
Oh, no, Kante's gone in.
I mean, yeah. Sorry. So the midfield. So if you sort the midfield, the midfield has to be Modric, Kante, and then probably De Bruyne.
So, I've got Modric and De Bruyne as a two-man midfield in my 3-4-3.
Okay.
I basically got the names: Oblak, Carvajal, Varane, Kante, Modric, De Bruyne, Messi, Ronaldo. How many is that? 1, 2, 3, 4, mm. 5, 6, 7, 8. So I've got 3 positions to fill.
Yeah.
A centre half, a left back, and someone else.
I need 2. So basically, I've got a 3-4-3, and I need. So I've got
Salah.
Blank, Ramos as my back three. Then I've got De Bruyne and Modric in the middle.
I can't believe you've got Ramos in there.
I need two wing backs. I need two wing
he's
backs.
He's captain.
Then I've got Mbappe, Ronaldo, and Messi as my front three, which means no Neymar.
Not for me.
Sorry, Ney.
I think Neymar's more talented than Mbappe, but Mbappe is actually putting it better.
Mbappe, obviously.
Mbappe's a better player.
How have I not had Mbappe? I was literally watching him
what
last
about Salah? What about Salah?
Oh, yeah.
Nah.
What happened, Mbappe?
I mean, Salah last season was an unstoppable machine.
The last thing I saw him do was that miss against Leicester, so sorry, you're caught.
Yeah. You can't score against Leicester.
Yeah. It's like when you get into that mindset, basically, you know. Bournemouth have lost 3 games in a row, so you're in your head of, they're never winning a game again. That's them done.
They look down in October.
Who's the best left-footed centre-back in the world? Is it Vertonghen or Laporte? Is there anyone from another country that I don't care about?
I think Vertonghen's very good. Umtiti?
Okay, I'm going to stick with Vertonghen.
Are you playing three at the back?
Yeah, obviously.
This is, by the way, I just realised this is great. Terrible.
No, it's
over
not.
An audio medium.
Yeah.
So if you can finalise your 11,
I'm sorry.
I'll just make a couple of programming notes.
Can we get Helen to put some of this?
Who's a really good right wing back? Who's really quick? Not like who's the new Dani Alves?
Gary Charles.
why
do you keep saying wing backs in the middle?
But this strikes to the heart of the issue here. So you were trying to pick a wing back. To fit your like imaginary system, when it should obviously be Danny Carvajal. Like, who's a better right back than Danny Carvajal?
Marcelo actually has got to be in there. Most my left
ahead of Mendy.
Yes, obviously ahead of Mendy.
I'm quite biased.
How many Man City players have you got?
Marcelo's won like 4 Champions Leagues.
I've got Shea Given, Richard Dunn, Wayne Bridge, Nigel De Jong, Craig Bellamy,
Elano.
Emmanuel Adebayor, Rocky Santa Cruz, Julian Lescott. I basically got the whole City 2009-10 team here.
Look, we're discussing this despite the wonder of the Nations League, which I have to say I've broadly in favour of.
Okay, right. So let's talk Nations League because the best 11 in the world segment absolutely tanked. Nations League, was it good to be at an England game that wasn't a meaningless friendly and actually?
Yeah.
So you're not getting. You're not getting the rash of withdrawals.
Yeah.
You know, you're getting like this actually means something. Like so, the Welbeck late equaliser that wasn't.
Oh, well, also one thing you have to give UEFA credit for actually is they've been very clever about this grouping thing because it means. Right across the spectrum of the 53 teams, whoever it is now, they're all playing teams around their level, which naturally creates a
better
little bit,
games. Yeah. It was so good not to be at like England 3 Malta 0.
Yeah.
Like it was really
Slovenia. It's always Slovenia.
Yeah. I thought it was great. Like it was really cool getting to see England. I mean, people didn't really think about it in the context of the tournament.
Yeah.
Like there was no one being like, oh no, England are gonna if England lose, then that means they're likely to get relegated into the second tier for the next Nations League. But you know, that'll come in time. But it was definitely cool to see England playing against a proper team where like you knew all the players and they were really good and better than us.
Yeah. It kind of added
a lot to the
The one thing I always think like in international breaks, particularly mid season, obviously it doesn't apply to a World Cup, but mid season what's really jarring about international break is that you get invested in the Premier League and the Premier League has so many storylines. Then you come to international break and like, what are the storylines here? There's nothing. Whereas this England-Spain game in particular, and even say France-Germany, even though the game itself was actually quite poor, it had a lot of narratives around it. I mean, with the biggest, how are England going to cope against a properly good side? Are Spain actually the properly good side they should be, given their quality and given what happened in the World Cup? So and there were just two, and there was a lot of that. So that was quite nice to it.
And I think what you're also getting out of this is the fact that it is semi-competitive. And so England, Croatia, England, Spain next month away from home.
Yeah.
Even if England do get relegated from that group, it's like, oh, okay, well, like, so what's the next tier down? You'll be playing against like a bit of Poland, a bit of Austria, whatever.
Not Ireland.
Beat those lads, back up. You know, like there is, and also, you know, say England did, I mean, it's obviously difficult after losing your first of only 4 games, but if England did qualify for the finals next summer, like that's a bit of a kind of fun thing for next June, isn't it? Like a week-long mini tournament where like England might win something. Like, you know, why not? Like it's a semi-good idea. It also struck me that it's kind of quite good for Sky Sports.
Yeah.
You know, the competitive... They don't get tournaments, you know, so they can't have tournaments. So this is about as good competitive football as they can get, because the World Cup qualifiers or whatever like tends to be pretty crap.
Although this is the wider debate to come from the week as well, that it's how much of a duty does, I suppose, the state have for games like this to actually be free to air? Which I mean, and like, so in Ireland there are a list of fixtures that have to be on free to air television. I think it's actually much longer than here.
Yeah. The football list is limited here.
Yeah, the football list is very limited here. And I do think
the list full stop is pretty limited now here, to be honest. Like what's actually on it? I think we've got World Cup, Olympics. What else?
I do think England International should be.
Or England International.
Yeah, I have to say. I mean,
Southgate was asked about this at his press conference on Friday and said ultimately he kind of shrugged and said, well, maybe it isn't ideal, but it's not up to me, and rights were sold centrally, not by the FA.
Free market capitalism. I mean, like, there's nothing you can do about it. I feel like that ship has sailed. Like, they get so much money from Sky that allows them to do things like build St. George's Park and whatever. Like, you've got to take the rough with the smooth.
But then it's kind of the long-term thing, ultimately. I mean, I suppose I remember, like, when I first got into football, it should have been Italia 90. And then because you have the buzz of Italia 90, then you get in, because you're excited for more football, if you're a child, basically, then you have the league coming and you're able to kind of invest in it all. So if you're taking away opportunities to watch, then it can kill that, and maybe kids need to have access to football in terms of watching it and playing it.
It's true. Yeah.
You need the right blend. It is correct. I was at an event last Monday. I was talking to Richard Scudamore, who's the outgoing chief exec of the Premier League, and he was saying, you know, basically we were talking about other leagues and their approaches to I guess attempted world domination, which is kind of what the Premier League are doing quite well at. And he said, you know, the best marketing device any league has is its own league on television. And what the Premier League, you know, I remember when Palace got promoted and they had to make like a £1.5 million worth of improvements to the television galley to accommodate 3D cameras, ultra HD cameras, all this sort of stuff. And the whole point is that if you're in the Premier League, what we need to have is really high quality television with like bright, vivid colours going around the world. And it's such that, like, if you watch like a Liga game or a Serie A game from like the wrong stadium, it looks like you're watching football in the 80s. You know, like really bad quality cameras, and it like the lighting's not good, whatever. If you watch any Premier League game, the lights are like bright, bright, bright. The colours are vivid.
Yeah,
and
yeah,
it's ultra HD. So I think what the Premier League realised a while ago is you need to be getting the high quality broadcast into as many homes as possible. And that's why, you know, they strike a deal that lets Match of the Day continue as well as being on Sky and all that sort of stuff. Whereas, so La Liga in the US, for example, went with beIN Sports, which is a really minority channel that it's hard to get hold of. Whereas Serie A is now on ESPN, which is like huge. Because
and it's been massive, not just investment in terms of money, but in terms of the play they're making of Serie A now.
Exactly.
But that's what, I mean, the Spanish thing is interesting, because obviously they're being very proactive about where they go next and how they challenge
England.
They've
got an office in the US now.
But it's difficult not to feel they're trying to be a bit too innovative at this point, because, you know, as much as value there is in this kind of 11 sport thing, the amount of people you see complain about, well, I don't have ready access to, this is a very kind of your da comment, and it's such a casual thing, but I actually think it is on a day-to-day level important. People, they just want to sit down and stick on a TV, and there is Spanish football, and that sucks people in. If you have to go through three or four little kind of even minor technological things to get it on, people are just less, I'll just see what's on telly.
The thing with La Liga as well is a lot of people in England, I mean, because it was always on Sky, it was what I call wallpaper viewing.
Yeah, yeah, that's what I mean.
You're at home
yeah.
like, on a Sunday evening, whatever.
You casually put on Barcelona.
But that is good, though.
You flick through Sky Sports, or whatever finishes, like whatever crap game on a Sunday, like Burnley versus Man United. And then it's like 7-ish on a Sunday night. Valencia versus Atletico Madrid's on Sky Sports too. Okay, bang. I'm going to have it on, and then you watch it and you're like, oh, actually Marcelino's Valencia are quite good and all this.
And now it's not on, and you've just got to watch like Catfish.
Yeah, you've got to watch Real Housewives of Atlanta. And you know, it is a thing about like...
I have actually watched that, it is good.
Have you ever watched Wags Miami?
Have you ever watched Say Yes to the Dress Atlanta?
Yeah, Say Yes to the Dress is... And what's the other one?
I've watched none of these programs.
Vanderpump Rules. Vanderpump Rules is a very good Bravo reality show about a restaurant in LA. Anyway, I've been passed a small notebook, notebook. So
listeners, I have come up with the correct answer to the World 11 question.
Jack's World 11.
I'm not having this.
David De Gea in goal. I might dispute that, but I'll let it go. Back three of the Spanish David Luiz, Sergio Ramos, Rafa Varane, and Vertonghen.
needs a left footer to go on the left of the back three.
Miguel has crossed out Vertonghen and put N'Golo Kante.
So I'm going for 4-4-2.
Going for 4-4-2.
Or 4-3-3.
Proper football man.
4-3-3.
Inexplicably, JPB has included Benjamin Mendy as his left back.
He's a unique threat. He's a unique player, Mendy.
Unique in that he barely played football for about 18 months. Miguel's gone for Marcelo, far more understandable. Central midfield, Modric, De Bruyne, and obviously for Miguel, that's got Kante like shoved in there as well to do the legwork. Carvajal on the right, nobody's arguing with. And then the front three, Messi, Ronaldo, Mbappe.
I would have quite liked to have not... I mean, Ronaldo hasn't scored for Juve, and I'm not sure...
Yeah, I mean...
I don't know, mate. Now I think about it, maybe I would like to not have him in, but say, I don't know who I'd have in...
Basically, cultural influence.
You could make a case for Kane, Salah, Griezmann, kind of a handful of different people in that front three instead.
What I'd like to ask you is, this is the current 11, which is, let's be honest, mainly based on last season in the World Cup. By the end of this season, which players do you think might have surged into this 11? Ooh. I would say I wonder if Naby Keita might be.
Yeah.
Maybe, yeah.
Little bits I've seen out of him, he sizzles.
He does look really good. I mean, if I were to have Keita, I'd go to 4-3-3 because I wouldn't want to not have De Bruyne and Modric in there. But if you had a 4-3-3, he would be a really good addition.
For part of last season, people thought Modric looked a bit leggy. He had not been as good as in previous seasons. So I wonder if he's physically going to stand up. Virgil van Dijk, I think, is a player on the brink of getting in there.
Yeah, I now you say that. Actually, wait a second. Isn't van Dijk left-footed?
Van Dijk's better than Vertonghen. And I think he's a better defender than Ramos as well. So
yeah, I think I probably would have, Van Dijk on the left of that back three. Mm.
And you know, if Harry Kane has another stellar season, I think he has to be in contention as well, I guess, because he's just scored lots of goals over the last 2-4 years.
Listeners, please, I mean, this sounds like a piss take, but it isn't. Please tweet us
your
world 11s, because I'm kind of curious to hear what people say.
Listener, so please tweet us.
Who, what entry to the first 11 or the best 11 will we look least favourably on? What player?
Right, and if there's a team that we think is really good, we'll send a prize.
Who's the obvious one that people put in that we don't? Nah.
What book was that you received?
Alexis Sanchez,
yeah. Pogba, maybe.
Pogba will be included.
Yeah, so. There'll be a lot of Pogbas out there.
The book I received was a book about Liverpool's boot room. I actually couldn't open the envelope properly yet.
Well, we get sent a load of books.
No. I know the correct answer. The correct answer is Mesut Ozil.
Yeah.
if you put Mesut Ozil in, please, we will block you. So you can't read. And that's all of us. So you won't be able to see any of our tweets ever again.
So there you go. We've got World 11s coming in. Tweet those to @ Miguel Delaney, @ Jack Pitbrook. Don't worry about me. There are prizes. I'll find a book on the desk. There's absolutely tons of books here. And we will send those. Anything else to say before we go?
Well, slight defense of ours. Not that I think he should be in the best 11 in the world. But without him, Germany looked very boxy and predictable on Thursday night.
Boxy.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, you went to Germany for a
while. They're all rigid and there's not much there.
Oh, yeah. How was your time at the Allianz Arena?
Good, yeah, yeah.
Great food.
Best ground is it your favourite ground in Europe?
I do like it a lot, but it just...
It's the best football stadium.
I'd have the Bernabeu way ahead of it.
In terms of quality, it's the best football stadium, I think, probably in the world.
All the facilities and all that.
Yeah, facilities, it's the best in the world.
It's impossible to get away from this. So ultimately, one of the great things about when you sit in a stadium like the Bernabeu, and I think the view in the Bernabeu is better because it's the steepness.
Steepness is massive.
It has an epic feel in both look and when you're sitting in your seat, but also you know the amount of football history that has happened in that stadium. Whereas the Allianz Arena...
Because they ram it down your throat.
Yeah, yeah. Well, but even still, like, just kind of your own... Whereas, like, the Allianz has only been alive for 12 years. So it is a little bit difficult to get away from that.
The Allianz, I think, is the best football stadium in the world in terms of facilities, atmosphere, quality, all the stuff that goes with it. It's not the stadium I'd most like to go to. It's not the stadium I was very impressed when I went there. It's not the stadium, like, I'm not, like, craving to go there. I would rather go to the Bernabeu, you're right, because there's something special about those.
San Siro up there.
League nights there. San Siro's great.
I kind of, it's weird, I completely agree with you about the Allianz, Ed. I agree, it's the best stadium. But Miguel, I kind of think that when I associate the Allianz with more than anything else, it's like Bayern playing well but inexplicably screwing it up in the Champions League.
The
2012 final.
The first time was at the Allianz.
And plenty of other times since where you're like, oh God, look at their first team, they're going to kill whoever they're playing. And then like by the end, like, Ronaldo scored again.
Oh, no. Here we go. Oh no.
I did both legs of the Atletico Bayern semi when it was Simeone against Guardiola.
Yeah. It's one of the best semi-finals. That is one of the best semi-finals ever.
Yeah.
And it was a real privilege because it was when I was in Madrid and Real Madrid were in the other semi-final. So I covered all of the legs of the semis, and I flew out to Munich for that, and it was just the perfect thing. It was Pep's team absolutely dominating and trying to break down a Simeone team basically the entire 90 minutes, which was absolute class. Great stadium, terrible weather, great place. But I think your point about the steepness and the rake is important. When you go to Valencia in December, the Mestalla is great for that.
I've never been to the Mestalla.
Reminds me a bit of the Bombonera in terms of its shape and its steepness.
Who plays there? Sorry.
Valencia.
No, Bombonera.
Oh,
Boca Juniors.
Right. Yeah. Boca's really steep, and it has to be because it's fitted into a neighbourhood, basically. There are houses behind it on all sides.
Not much mention of Camp Nou here, actually. It has its flaws, has to be said, but is...
It's a great press position, you're incredibly high up and stuff. But as a spectator, I don't think the new Camp's that great.
Actually, one thing on that, Old Trafford has become actually a very, very dated stadium. It's almost bad now in almost everything except when you sit in the seat then, and you basically look around and the view is incredible. The scale it says is made, and then of course again it's got that feel of a lot of football history has happened here.
I'm surprised they haven't tried to get bigger.
I know,
it's not that much money to them.
Anfield is actually, I think, in terms of if we're going for the kind of more modern, what you talk about with the Allianz Arena, the modern facilities and all that, Anfield has probably surpassed Old Trafford as an experience. And I don't just mean that from kind of sitting in the press seats, although obviously that's
away end. I remember going to the away end at Anfield years ago, and it's very tight. Mm. It was quite an old stadium. I mean, they've built a new stand, but it's quite
the new stand is very impressive.
Any other stadium opinions we want to get out before we go?
Really, genuinely excited for the new Tottenham Stadium.
Yeah,
I think I've done a virtual reality tour. It's going to be fantastic.
And added to that, it took us 1 hour and 40 minutes to get home from Wembley the other night.
Yeah, that's true. The worst people in the world are football journalists who complain about their job. But despite that, I'm going to go for it anyway. It was Wembley, fucking hell. I got in at what time did we leave?
We left at
11:40, and I got home at I live in Peckham, so it's still in London. I got home at 1:30, so it took almost 2 hours.
Did you all the way to Elephant Castle? And then
no, because there was some issue. This is terrible.
This is awful. Sorry. Right, we're going to go. Thank you for listening this far. If you have, we will talk to you next week when there's real Barclays, pure Barclays back.
Games on Saturday.
Yeah, back. We should have previewed those, but we didn't. So we'll talk to you next week for a lot of Liverpool, Tottenham. Is it Liverpool, Tottenham?
Liverpool, Tottenham, and then it's Watford United.
Then Watford, the league leaders versus Manchester United. Until then, thank you, Miguel. Thank you, Jack. Goodbye.